Now to Luke chapter 11. Luke chapter 11. We want to begin our reading this morning in verse 37. Luke 11, 37 to the end of the chapter. When Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him. So he went in and reclined at the table. But the Pharisee, noticing that Jesus did not first wash before the meal, was surprised. Then the Lord said to him, "Now then, you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people, did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? But give what is inside the dish to the poor, and everything will be clean for you. Woe to you, Pharisees, because you give God a tenth of your mint, rue, and all other kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone. Woe to you, Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you, because you are like unmarked graves which men walk over without knowing it." One of the experts in the law answered him, "Teacher, when you say these things, you insult us also." Jesus replied, "And you experts in the law, woe to you, because you load people down with burdens they can hardly carry, and you yourselves will not lift one finger to help them. Woe to you, because you build tombs for the prophets, and it was your forefathers who killed them. So you testify that you approve of what your forefathers did. They killed the prophets, and you build their tombs. Because of this, God in his wisdom said, 'I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill, and others they will persecute. Therefore, this generation will be held responsible for the blood of all the prophets that has been shed since the beginning of the world, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who was killed between the altar and the sanctuary. Yes, I tell you, this generation will be held responsible for it all. Woe to you experts in the law, because you have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered, and you have hindered those who were entering.'" When Jesus left there, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and to besiege him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say. When we think of sin, we almost instinctively think of high crimes and misdemeanors. We think of crimes like murder and adultery and grand larceny, and we think of misdemeanors like drunkenness and gambling and maybe even speeding. I do not mean to minimize these as sins, but I think it is worthy of note that the New Testament pays far more attention to sins of the heart and attitude than it does to the external sins such as we have just mentioned. Not surprisingly, the greatest opposition to Jesus came not from the criminal element or the radicals in his society, but rather from the religious leaders of his day. It came from scribes and Pharisees, experts in the law. The same is true probably today, 20 centuries later. I am confident that the strongest, most persistent antagonism to the things that Christ stood for comes not out of our prisons or even out of our godless universities, but it comes from pulpits and seminaries and denominations that have substituted their own notions of morality for those that Jesus taught. In keeping with this state of affairs, it's not surprising that Jesus reserved his harshest words not for the murderers and adulterers and thieves of his day, but rather for the self-righteous and the hypocrites, people whom he called blind guides of the blind. The same would be true today, I believe, because Phariseeism is by no means dead. Our text opens up with Jesus being invited to a Pharisee's home. The Pharisees were a religious party with political overtones, maybe something like the Puritans of 17th century England or the moral majority in our own 20th century. Their name came from the Hebrew word meaning to separate, and it meant that they had separated themselves from the common people. They separated themselves by means of a host of religious and legal scruples that they observed. Their basic beliefs were pretty much orthodox, but they allowed themselves to be caught up in the bondage of legalism. They judged righteousness by one's conformity to a long list of external rules and regulations. What this particular Pharisee's motive was in inviting Jesus to come to his house, we do not know. We are told that he was shocked that Jesus didn't wash his hands before the meal. It's important we realize here that this is not a concern of hygiene for this Pharisee. He's not concerned that Jesus will spread germs or hepatitis A. This is a matter of religious tradition. Listen as William Barclay describes the situation. The law, he writes, not God's law, but man's addition to God's law, laid it down that before a man ate, he must wash his hands in a certain way, and that he must also wash them between the courses. As usual, every littlest detail was worked out. Large stone vessels of water were specially kept for the purpose because ordinary water might be unclean. The amount of water used must be at least a quarter of a log, that is, enough to fill 1.5 eggshells. First, the water must be poured over the hands, beginning at the tips of the fingers and running right up to the wrists. Then the palm of each hand must be cleansed by rubbing the first into the other, the one fist into the other. Finally, water must again be poured over the hand, this time beginning at the wrist and running down to the fingertips. To the Pharisee, to omit the slightest detail of this was to sin. Now, don't think for a moment that Jesus was unaware of these regulations or these traditions. He ignored them on purpose. When he saw the shock on the Pharisee's face, he used that response as an opportunity to expose 6 major sins of his heart and of the hearts of those gathered around him. But friends, he also exposes these same sins in our hearts. For these are sins to which religious people are particularly vulnerable and susceptible. These sins won't land you in jail. These are not high crimes and misdemeanors, but they may land you in hell. The first is this: the religious hypocrite pays more attention to external rules than he does to internal attitudes. The Pharisaical regulations about how a person should wash his hands before a meal came not out of the Old Testament. They came from the interpretations and the commentaries on the Old Testament that were written by experts in the law. Over time, these interpretations came to be more sacred to the Jewish people than did the law itself. Much like our own systems of theology can become almost a Bible to the second power, a controlling influence that causes us to twist the scriptures in order to fit it into our system. The Pharisees were experts at this sort of thing. Jesus exposes this sinful tendency by means of an analogy. He says, "You Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness." Now, this is similar to what Jesus taught in Matthew 15. He said, "For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, slander. These are what make a man unclean, but eating with unwashed hands does not make him unclean." What Jesus is saying is that even the high crimes really come out of the heart. And we ought to be paying attention more to the heart than we do to the hands. The Pharisees were more concerned with what a man did than they were with what he was. But Jesus calls them fools for this. "You foolish people," he said. "Did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? But give what is inside the dish to the poor, and everything will be clean to you." Now, I don't think Jesus is saying here that if you give alms to people, you will earn salvation and everything will be cool. I don't think that's his point. I think he is saying that we need to have a right inward state when we do anything outwardly, or it is worthless. We must give ourselves first, or our money is an empty gesture. I'm reminded when I read this verse or two here in Luke 11 about an incident from Samuel's life. He lined up the sons of Jesse to pick the one who would be the next king of Israel. Now, God had already picked that person, but Samuel was supposed to be the one who anointed him. And as these sons filed by, Samuel picked several of them that looked really kingly. But God said this to Samuel: "The Lord does not look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." And God told Samuel to pick the youngest son of Jesse, a mere shepherd boy named David, to be the king of Israel. The point of that statement is not that God does not see the outside, for certainly he does, but he is far more concerned with the inside. What is your heart like today, friends? You look pretty good on the outside, actually. You look great. What's the heart like? Did we spend more time preparing the body before we came to church today than we spent preparing the heart for worship? If so, there may be a sense in which God is fingering a bit of Pharisaism in our own lives. Now there's a second sin of the religious hypocrite. He majors on the minor and ignores the most important principles. "Woe to you, Pharisees, because you give God a tenth of your mint, rue, and all other kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God." Now, tithing was a huge issue to the Pharisees, much bigger than it ought to have been. True, it was commanded in the Old Testament for the people to tithe, but tithing was intended to be a loving response to God for all the good gifts that he had given to his people. The Pharisees turned it into a burdensome mockery. They even went out to their gardens and counted all the stalks and gave 1 out of 10 to the temple. Friends, when we concentrate on the trivial, we will almost always neglect what is more important. One only has so much spiritual and emotional energy. If it is devoted to counting stalks, it can't be devoted to one's love of God or one's love for a neighbor. Now, Jesus doesn't tell them that their tithing was wrong, at least if they were doing it the way the Old Testament commanded it to be done. He says, "You should have done that. But there was something more important for you to do first." Their focus was wrong. Their priorities were wrong. Their heart attitude was wrong. Now, all of us have known Christians who were very scrupulous about their church attendance, about their tithing, about their abstinence from such things as alcohol and tobacco. But those same individuals could cut a Christian brother to shreds with their tongues over some perceived lack in that person's life. And all of us have known Christians who are quick to speak a word of testimony for Christ at church, but their word out in the work world isn't worth the breath used to utter it. They are the kind of people about whom I occasionally hear someone say, I would rather do business with an unbeliever than with a Christian like that. James speaks of such people in the first chapter of his epistle. The 26th verse, he says, if anyone considers himself religious and yet does not keep a tight rein on his lips, he deceives himself and his religion is worthless. Those are pretty strong words. Is he saying that you can be a devoutly religious person and yet your religion be worthless? Yes, that's exactly what he's saying. And he's not saying it to Hindus or Buddhists or Muslims. He's saying it to professing Christians. Friends, the answer when we see hypocrisy in the church is not to quit going to church or to quit giving or to quit testifying. That's the response of some people. They say, if there are hypocrites in the church, I don't want to have anything to do with the church. Well, let me tell you something. There are hypocrites everywhere. There are no more in the church than there are at the country club or in politics or at the PTA. And unless you drop out of society entirely, you're not going to get away from them. And even if you do drop out of society, you're going to still be around one hypocrite more than likely. The best response is to refocus your own life and make sure that the most important issues of morality and integrity do not take a back seat to religious observances. Third, the religious hypocrite loves attention-getting places of honor and defiles his followers. I'm combining the next two woes in verses 43 and 44 here. Woe to you, Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you, because you are like unmarked graves, which men walk over without knowing it. Now, the advantage of the front seats in the synagogue is that they face the audience. You know, in some churches, there are big chairs back behind the pulpit where the pastor sits and watches the audience. That's the way it was in the synagogue. And the advantage was that you could be noticed there. And that's why the Pharisees wore long robes also when they went out into the marketplace. People would see them and give them special greetings. I didn't realize really how this worked until about 9 years ago. An incident occurred at our church. We were going through the 50-day spiritual adventure. It was on 50 days to welcome Christ to our workplace. And I was preaching one Sunday on the biblical value of work. We asked everyone to come to work in their work clothes. How many remember that Sunday? There are just a few of you that remember that Sunday. They had people wearing nurses' uniforms and surgical scrubs. And I remember Tony Kinney wore a moon suit because he was involved in environmental protection. We had all kinds of clothes. Well, my clothes weren't any different from anybody else's because my clothes don't distinguish me. But I thought, well, I'll go to my friend Don Wilkinson, who was the rector of Church of the Epiphany, the Episcopal Church over at Daugherty Ferry in Ballas, and borrow a clerical collar for that Sunday. And so I did. That Sunday I dressed up in a black shirt and white clerical collar and headed off for church. On the way, I stopped at White Castle, not for belly bombers, but for coffee, like I did every Sunday. I forgot what I was wearing. As I went in there and went up to the counter, this young lady behind the counter says, "Good morning, Father." I was kind of speechless for a moment. And then she gave me the coffee free. And I thought, this isn't bad. Maybe I ought to get one of these for myself. Now, by sharing that illustration, I don't mean to imply that everyone who wears a clerical collar or a robe is seeking the praise of men or even free coffee. But it is interesting what Jesus says later on in the book of Luke chapter 20, Verse 46, he says, "Beware of the teachers of the law. They like to walk around in flowing robes and love to be greeted in the marketplaces and have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses and for a show make lengthy prayers. Such men will be punished most severely." I think that one verse is enough to keep me out of a robe for the rest of my life. And ought to cause, I think, any religious person to think twice about wearing clerical vestments. There are, of course, other ways to seek the praise of men. I knew a minister who probably never wore a clerical collar or a robe in his life, but he had on his office wall large photographs of himself with major Christian celebrities and athletes and so forth. He had himself with Billy Graham and Mark Hatfield and Tom Landry and on. The wall was just covered with these things. Now, I knew that man well enough to know that he suffered from an inferiority complex. He probably also suffered from Pharisaism. Does this syndrome affect only ministers? I don't think so. Some lay people want instant recognition when they do a good deed. And if they don't get it, they get upset. I remember a man in my former church, this was many, many years ago, who gave a very sizable gift to a Christian college, and that Christian college honored him by naming a major new building after him. But because I did not give him recognition at the church regarding that gift, he pulled out and quit giving to the church and quit serving. And today, I don't know, this must be at least 15, 17 years later, he is still just an observer where once he had been an active Christian. This disease can affect any one of us. Now, the reference to unmarked graves there in verse 44 seems a little strange until we understand that the Old Testament said that a Jew became defiled when he came into contact with a dead body. And Numbers 19:16 says, "Anyone out in the open who touches someone who has been killed with a sword or someone who has died a natural death or anyone who touches a human bone or a grave will be unclean for 7 days." Now, this regulation probably had hygienic purposes as well as ceremonial purposes. But the Pharisees extended the defilement to cover even an unwary traveler who happened to walk over a grave and didn't even know it. And so at the time of Passover, the Jews would go out and whitewash all the graves to make sure that the travelers who were, the pilgrims who were coming in from all over the world wouldn't step on an unmarked grave and therefore be unable to go to the temple. Now, Jesus used this tradition to say, in essence, that just as those who stepped on unmarked graves were considered ceremonially unclean, so those who followed in the teachings of the Pharisees became morally unclean. Now, there's an interesting interlude that you noticed here between the first half of this text and the last half. It says in verse 45, "One of the experts in the law answered him." By the way, these experts in the law were what we call scribes. These were Jewish theologians. They were known by their profession, whereas the Pharisees were known by their political party. Many scribes were Pharisees, but not all of them. And this scribe has heard Jesus lambast the Pharisees. And he wants to give Jesus an opportunity to exempt the theologians from these scathing criticisms. So he says, "Teacher, when you say these nasty things about the Pharisees, you insult us theologians too." And Jesus says, "You think I've insulted you? That's exactly what I intended to do. In fact, I have some special condemnations for you experts in the law. You want to hear them? Well, here's one. The religious hypocrite is quick to condemn, but slow to help. You load people down with burdens they can hardly carry, and you yourselves will not lift one finger to help them. Well, what kind of burdens is he talking about? Well, instead of explaining God's law in such a way that it was an encouragement to the people to help them apply God's truth to their lives, the Pharisees applied it by means of a myriad of legalistic requirements. For example, while the Old Testament commanded people not to work on the Sabbath so they could rest and worship, the Pharisees and the scribes, particularly the scribes, elaborated on that simple principle and taught that a man must not carry a burden in his right hand or in his left hand, in his bosom or on his shoulder. But, they said, he could carry it on the back of his hand or with his foot or with his mouth or with his elbow or in his ear or in his hair or in his wallet if the opening was downward. Now, you multiply this kind of nonsense by 613 laws that there were in the Old Testament, and obviously no one but a professional theologian could possibly manage this burden. But those theologians knew all the loopholes, so they could actually do just about anything they wanted while the people were in bondage to this legalism. And they wouldn't lift one finger to help them out of it because they were glad to see them in bondage. It gave them power and influence over the people. Fifth, the religious hypocrite finds it easier to honor dead saints than living ones. I think this is what Jesus is saying in verses 47 and following. He says, "Woe to you because you build tombs for the prophets, for it was your forefathers who killed them. So you testify that you approve of what your forefathers did. They killed the prophets, and you built their tombs." The scribes wanted the people to think that by building the tombs of the prophets, they were honoring the prophets. But the only way to honor a prophet is to follow his teachings. I believe there's a subtle and unspoken reference here to the fact that there is a prophet standing in their midst, whom they are failing to honor, even though all the Old Testament prophets looked forward to him and predicted his coming. The scribes admired the dead prophets, but when they met a living one, they tried to kill him. The scribes honored the dead prophets with tombs and memorials, but they dishonored the living ones with persecution and death. Now, Jesus goes on to say in verse 50 that that generation would be held liable for the death of all the prophets from the beginning of the world. And to kind of elaborate on that, he says from Genesis to Revelation. That's really what he's saying when he speaks of the death of Abel to the death of Zechariah. Abel, his death is recorded in the book of Genesis. Zechariah's death is recorded in 2 Chronicles, which was the last book of the Hebrew Old Testament. The order was different. So Jesus is basically saying from Genesis to Revelation, all the prophets who were killed, their blood is on your hands, he says to those people. Friends, is there any sense in which we honor dead saints today more than we do living ones? I think of the praise that was heaped upon Mother Teresa by many political and religious leaders who espouse abortion on demand and even support partial birth abortion. When that woman, with every ounce of energy in her body, rebuked those same people for that evil, they take the opportunity to put themselves on the right side by honoring her once she's dead. They did not honor what she taught or what she lived for. We evangelicals have our own saints, Luther, Calvin, Spurgeon, Moody. We can quote them and praise them, but do we honor the truths that they taught? Finally, Jesus lays one more trip on the scribes and Pharisees when he says in verse 52, "Woe to you, experts in the law, because you have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered, and you have hindered those who were entering." I believe this one verse is a terrible condemnation on the liberal church in the United States of America. For decades now, the mainline churches as a whole, and there are some notable exceptions, so this is not a blanket condemnation, but the mainline churches as a whole have professed to be religious guides, but they are actually what Jesus called blind guides. They have turned people away from the Bible to political and social issues. They have scoffed at the need to be born again in favor of reforming one's life. They have called evil good and good evil. In essence, they have not entered the kingdom of God by faith in Jesus Christ, and they have hindered those who were seeking God. What a terrible position to be in at the day of judgment. But it is possible that we, even in the conservative churches of Christianity, can be obstacles to the truth, discouraging people from coming to Christ because of self-righteous attitudes or legalistic requirements or just a lack of love and acceptance of people. We can even be obstacles by our preaching. I have been in evangelical churches where the pastor's interpretations of Scripture are so esoteric and so sprinkled with Greek and Hebrew words that the ordinary man throws up his hands in despair of ever understanding the Bible for himself. The Bible becomes a book of riddles that can only be solved by the experts. Friends, Phariseeism is alive and well in the church today. There are many who believe that so long as the externals of religion are carried out, that is all that matters. Their hearts might be as black as hell. They might be utterly lacking in charity and even justice. So long as they go through the correct motions at the correct time, they consider themselves okay in the eyes of God. I'll never forget the image in the movie The Godfather, where Michael Corleone goes to the cathedral to christen his little boy. And the priest asks him a series of questions. Do you believe in God the Father? Do you believe in Jesus Christ, his Son? Do you believe in the Holy Spirit? Do you renounce Satan and all his works? And he responds to each of these, yes. But interspersed in that scene are scenes of preparation for five assassinations that he has ordered to be carried out at the exact time that he is christening his son. Now, I don't think there are many of us here today who are tempted with quite that level of hypocrisy. But hypocrisy is an insidious disease that blinds the perpetrator to its very presence in his life. We may be in church every Sunday. We may be diligent students of the Bible. We may be generous in our giving. But if our hearts are full of pride and contempt, if we have no love in dealing with our neighbors, if we are unjust to our employees or dishonest to our employers, then we are as guilty as the scribes and Pharisees of Jesus' day. As I close, I want to quote to you from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew 5:20, he said, "I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, friends, this is not a call for greater separatism than the Pharisees practice. This is not a call for more stringent legalism than the scribes followed in their lives. It is actually a call to abandon human righteousness altogether and to rely on a completely different kind of righteousness, the kind of righteousness talked about in Romans chapter 3. No one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. But now a righteousness from God, apart from law, has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There is no difference between people, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. This tells us that God saves all those who abandon human righteousness, who acknowledge their sin and accept the righteousness of Jesus Christ. He died for you. He paid your penalty. And by faith in him, you can have eternal life. By faith in him alone. Our text ends this way. When Jesus left there, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and to besiege him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say. Instead of repenting, they were offended and intensified their opposition. That's how they responded to these words spoken to us today. How will we respond to these words? Would you bow your head with me?